Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're starting this show today by talking with you about candy. You might have a weakness for maybe a particular kind of candy. It might be a chocolate truffle. I like those. Salted caramels. I like those. A tangy fruit chew. I'm not as, it's not as high on my list, but maybe it is on yours, and I think there's something for the kid in all of us. And today we talk candy making just in time for Valentine's Day with our guest, Richard Hartle. He is a professor of food science at UW-Madison, and Rich's confectionery research includes controlling phase transitions of sugar, caramel, lipids, and ice cream. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Let us know the challenges you run into when you make candy. What do you want to know about baking sugar syrup, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Rich Hartle, welcome. Good to have you with us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
What's your favorite candy at the moment?
That would be the first question. And it varies. So we make a really mean orange slice. And so I often like those. But I also like salted caramels, chocolate-covered salted caramels. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, I think, almost any time of the year. How'd you get started in candy making and food science?
Well, long path. So I have a bachelor's degree in physics and a PhD in engineering, but that PhD was based on sugar crystallization. So I actually did a PhD on trying to understand and control sugar crystallization. So when I got hired here at UW, my predecessor, Joe Von Elb, kind of put his arm around me and said, "Rich, you know something about sugar crystals." And an old candy maker once told me that if you know how to control sugar in the phase transitions, you could be a good candy maker. And I like to joke now that, you know, I study phase transitions of sugars, but I'm not a very good candy maker.
Well, it's good to hear Joe Von Elb's name as well. Joe and I talked many a time on the show. And I always enjoyed, rest his soul, enjoyed him very, very much. Well, yeah. So what's so fascinating about making candy? Is it?
Well, for me, it's all about the science.
Yeah.
So I don't mind eating it at the end, although, like I said, I don't make good candy, so you don't always want to eat what I make. But for me, it's all about the science. And it's actually quite surprising how much science there is. I teach a senior level class for our food science students called Confectionery Science, and its reputation is that it's a lot of fun, but it's hard.
So what are the main categories of candies? I think we almost laid them out, but go ahead.
Well, there's the chocolate confections, of course, but it ranges everywhere from hard candy to taffy to caramels and fudge to marshmallow, even sweet tarts, tableted candies fit into that category. And again, there's many more in between. Even chewing gum. I notice you're chewing some gum.
Yeah.
Even that is considered in the confectionery category.
So which candies do you think are the most beginner-friendly?
Good question. A lot of them are easy to make, relatively easy to make. I would put caramel and fudge into that category. Even hard candy is relatively easy to make as long as you're careful about the high temperatures. Things that are hard to make, almost impossible in the kitchen, would be licorice. And if you tried to make chocolate from cocoa beans, that might be a challenge as well.
And I just read this morning that you should not be giving licorice for a Valentine's gift because it... what is it? Inhibits the libido? Have you heard that one?
No, but dark or black licorice, which is, you know, true licorice, the red licorice is really just, I mean, you look at some of the packages and they don't actually say licorice, but dark licorice that has the licorice extract is I mean, supposedly there's some, if you have high blood pressure, probably not good to eat a lot of it.
Anyway, okay. Let's talk about equipment. What are the basic equipment or pieces that a home chef needs to make candy?
Well, for the most part, you need a pot and a stove and a stirring and a, something to stir it with. A candy thermometer might be a good thing to have there as well, because a candy thermometer has the different levels of cook, so to speak. The soft ball, hard ball, soft crack, hard crack, and those are based on temperatures, based on viscosities, and ultimately the texture. So really, don't need for many of them. You don't need much more than a pot and a mixer.
And do you have a, in terms of, the thermometer I have a very expensive thermometer. Well, expensive for me. I think I paid $120 for it. But it you can use it for meat or whatever you want, including candies and so forth. Do you have a favorite one that you like?
Well, in our labs, we use cheap $10 ones because students tend to break them. But when we do our own, we've got one that's, it's probably a couple $100 that between the probe and the recorder. So yeah, they can be pretty expensive, just as long as you have something that goes to the right temperature range.
You're in good shape. Okay, so, and the ingredients, the foundation ingredients, sugar, I guess.
Yep. So sugar. So if you look at most candies, chocolate excluded, the first two ingredients are sugar and corn syrup, and maybe in different ratios. So typically, things that are crystalline or semi-crystalline have more sugar than corn syrup. Things that are not crystalline have more corn syrup than sugar. So in the candy parlance, we call corn syrup a doctoring agent, because it manipulates and controls the crystallization of the sugar.
So when you're using corn syrup, are you going to get a different kind of, what does it do? Does it give you a different kind of mouthfeel or make the candy different in some fashion, I suppose?
Yeah, if you use too much corn syrup, it gets it's kind of more, I don't know what the right term is. It's machinable, more plastic, I think would be the right term for it. And again, it prevents crystallization, but it also, depending on the type of corn syrup and how much you use, can also make it more sticky, hygroscopic. So all of those factors go into choices that we use in commercial candy making.
Karen emailed us. She loves to make her mom's divinity for friends for Valentine's Day. Sometimes it's perfect, light and fluffy. Other times it's dense. And she wonders what gives, and should she use water or oil-based flavorings and color rings?
So, I mean, that's an expanded sort of hard candy type of product, similar to some other types of things. Like in Wisconsin, we get I'm blanking on the name, chocolate covered sponge or foam, that kind of thing. And essentially, that's cooked up to hard crack, so you get moisture content pretty low. Foam it in some way. Often, it's just adding some bicarb and then getting it to cool quickly, so you've got a lot of air pockets, and they're held together by the glassy nature of that sugar phase. And so, a couple things that you could go wrong: you let the air escape after you've added the bicarb, or perhaps you didn't cook to a high enough temperature, and you have more water than you think you do, and it could be more dense because of that. Now, one thing, just to talk a little bit about the science, but I mean, we cook up to hard crack and get to a certain water content. Typically, that's 2 to 3% moisture, but the amount of moisture left in the candy also depends on what the atmospheric pressure is and the humidity of the air outside, and all of those can impact the final product. And in fact, I know some candy makers that in their by their candy station, they also have a barometer. And when the pressure goes up too high or down too low, they don't cook because they can't control the water content.
Wow. Rich Hartle, our guest today, professor of food science at UW-Madison. We're talking with him about candy making. Maybe you've got an experience to share, or maybe you've got a question about candy making. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Our producer today, Clara Neipert, our engineer, A. Emily Ralph. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with our guest today, Professor Rich Hartle, a professor of food science at UW-Madison, and he does a lot of research in the area of candy and candy making. We're talking kind of about the chemistry of it, as a matter of fact, with him, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your own experiences with candy making. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Dodeau was just texting, we were talking about a sea foam. She talked about sea foam, and is sea foam the same thing as divinity?
Differences, but essentially it's the same character of candy where, again, you got a foam, air pockets, that were produced by some, usually it's a chemical reaction with bicarbonate, and then the air is controlled or held by a sugar glass. So cook the sugar syrup up to a high hard crack temperature to bring the water down. And when it cools down, that sugar syrup turns into a glass.
Does it look like a glass?
It can. In fact, some of the old-time stories, some of the old-time Westerns, according to the stories I hear, I was not around back then, but so they used sugar glass to make the panes of glass that the bad guys went through. Because, you know, if you use silica, the glass transition is high enough and it's sharp enough that you cut. I mean, my mom said, don't play with glass. But they made them with sugar glass because they have the same appearance, same crack, but they're not as hard. The problem is they picked up moisture too fast, and so I couldn't use them after the morning. That's the story I hear.
Interesting. Let's go to Richard in Manitowoc. Richard, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the air. Yeah, I was going to ask your guest speaker, if I wanted to make my own throat lozenges and cough suppressants, what would be the best additive to put in there, and how would I go about it?
Cough suppressants. So that brings me back to my younger days, where anything candy-like was fair game. And so I often had a lot of sore throats because cough drops are really just candy with a little bit something else in there. And typically the things that they put in there are things like menthol. But I've seen cough drops that have something like a pectin. So something that thickens up the fluid. So when you swallow it, it coats your mouth. Coats your whatever as it passes down the throat. So, what's the best one to do? Boy, I don't have a good answer to that. But again, the cough drops out in the marketplace. I mean, the Luden's cough drops are still available, same ones that I had as a kid. And do they work? I don't know. I just enjoyed the candy part of it.
Richard, thank you for calling. Terry and Mequon will go to you. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. I was laughing when you talked about the divinity and not making it at certain points in the barometer. I, as a teenager, entered candy and divinity specifically at the county fair, which was held in late July, and our house had no air conditioning, and the humidity was up. It was about 90 degrees, and I was very determined to get this entry into the fair. And I remember scooping and my parents holding little plates out and running all over the house. And they'd stuck one in the freezer and some in the refrigerator and some on the shelf. And we had candy all over the kitchen.
What did you win? Did you win a prize, Terry?
I won first prize. Yes, I did. Yes.
Great. So the refrigerator freezer trick is actually a pretty good one because, one, it gets it cold, so it brings it down below its glass transition, even if there's a little bit extra moisture in it. Of course, as soon as you warm it up again, it starts to flow, and then it starts to suck up moisture from that humid air. It's one of the real problems with that kind of candy.
Oh, Terry, that's a great story. Thanks so much for sharing it. Appreciate it very much. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, sea foam is not made it's made with a sugar water and egg whites. Egg whites are what gives it the volume.
Egg whites are what rich. Thanks, Ruth. Rich comment.
Yeah, that's one of the ways of protecting the air cells. So egg whites, proteins are surface active, and so they go to the surface and help stabilize it. But the primary stabilization is the sugar glass. So both of those happen. Both of those are important.
Yeah. Ruth, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. We'll open lines, get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. You know, we've been throwing out and talking about sugars here, but really there are many different kinds of sugars. Which one is the most common for candy?
Well, oftentimes when we say sugar, we really mean sucrose. But sugar is a broad term, right? So corn syrup actually fits in the category of sugars because it's glucose, maltose, maltotriose. It's a glucose polymer. Starch is a glucose polymer that gets broken down to make corn syrup. Glucose and fructose, not uncommon. The combination of those is often called invert sugar. And so that can be either be added to candies separately, or actually through cooking or acid, can be caused or can be formed in the processing of candy. Those are the main ones. If you start looking at sugar-free type candies, then we're talking about sugar alcohols, which are not technically sugars, but they're derived from sugars. But things like maltitol, isomalt, things like that. And then there's some more exotic ones. So one that's kind of popular in the industry today is a monosaccharide called allulose. And it has some interesting properties like sucrose, and people are starting to use that as a sucrose replacement.
Interesting. Gene in Merrill has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have what's for me an amusing story from my childhood. My sister and I discovered the stages that divinity does go through as they're making it incorrectly, to our disadvantage. We were doing it on a summer day, and we obviously got it past the hardball point so that it was kind of gummy. And so we pulled it out and thought, well, maybe we could treat it like taffy. We didn't know much about taffy either, so we started pulling it, and that seemed doable. And then I got the bright idea. We could shape it into a ball, and it turned out to be about the size of a softball. So, of course, we took it outside, and I got the bat, and she got the ball, and she pitches it at me. I take a solid whack at it, and the thing breaks to smithereens. It's so hard by then. So I went leaping for it, fell on the ground, dislocated my kneecap to the side of my knee, and my poor father comes rushing out, and they have to call an ambulance. So to this day, I don't really like divinity a whole lot. I've never eaten any.
And it could get you in many ways.
Oh, that's a great story, Gene. Oh, well, I'm sorry that you hurt yourself, but it was a great story about divinity and making it and softball sized. Oh, Tim in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning. Years ago, this is back in the 50s when I was a kid, my mother made chocolate fudge, and she only made it in the wintertime. She'd take it out in the back porch where it's colder, and then she'd let it cool, and then she'd bring it back in, and she'd only turn it and beat it by hand. Then she'd put it back out. She did this like four or five times. It took her half a day to do this, but it turned out really delicious. And I was wondering what the on and off beating and getting it cold did to it.
That's a good question, Tim.
That's a good question, Tim. It's I mean, it's so fudge is a partially crystalline candy. So in fact, we call in the commercial candy industry, we call fudge a crystallized caramel. So it's basically the same matrix as caramel, but then you partially crystallize it. And that's so if you've ever seen fudge being made at a resort type thing, they cook it off. And if they don't use fondant as a seed, then they pour it onto a table, allow it to cool, and then they work it by hand. And that working by hand is what's promoting the sugar crystallization. When you put it outside in the cold, of course, that's cooling down. Then you bring it back in and warm it back up a little bit and then beat the heck out of it. Why you would have to do that four times beyond me. But the aim of that process is to get a lot of really small sugar crystals that give that fudge-like texture to the product. So whatever it's doing by putting it in the Wisconsin winter and then bringing it back out and beating it, that's an interesting new technique that I've not heard of.
Tim, you know what? I bet you your mother did it four times because her mother did it four times. That's probably exactly why. But the product, and Rich, you can see where this would make for a pretty fine candy.
I think controlling the sugar crystallization that way, as soon as you cool it down to that low a temperature, it's becoming glassy-like. Not maybe a glass yet, but that's inhibiting sugar crystallization. When you warm it back up again and beat it, that's when the sugar crystals form. So, again, an interesting way of controlling that sugar crystallization.
Yeah. Tim, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it very much. Fran from Viroqua emailed us. Fran's made angel food every year for Christmas for many years. She recognizes it can be finicky based on humidity and weather. In recent years, it's consistently turned out dense instead of light and airy, despite every effort to be as precise and careful as possible. Fran has made sure her baking soda is fresh and replaced multiple candy thermometers. Any other suggestions?
Yeah. Sometimes variability comes. When you make chocolate chip cookies at home, often there's just some inherent variability from the different ingredients that you use and the different processes that you use. And the same is true for making candies. So some of those things we've talked about already, it could be the humidity and pressure. It could be that if you're using some corn syrup, it could be that that's different. So unfortunately, I don't have any magic to tell you there that it happens here as well, that sometimes we get things that work out and sometimes we get things that don't work out, even though we've made it 100 times before. So I don't know all of the ins and outs of the variability of the ingredients and the process. But again, it sounds like you're doing all the right things by controlling the temperature that you cook to. And again, you don't have any control over the atmospheric conditions, but unfortunately, that's the nature of things.
Thank you very much for that question, Fran. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your own question or maybe your own experience to share as we talk candy making with our guest today, Rich Hartle, from the UW-Madison Food Science Department, where he is a professor. You know, chocolate, I was thinking back before the show. There was a lady, and this is when I was a young guy, from Illinois, and a friend of mine knew her, and she made chocolates, and they were just the best chocolates you could ever made. And the story with her was she got her chocolate from Hershey's. Hershey used to sell its best chocolate. You could buy it as anybody could buy their top of the line chocolate before they added everything to it. And then they quit doing that. They wouldn't allow it to be sold just to anybody. And the lady from Illinois made some of her chocolates up. She still had some of the Hershey's, the good Hershey's chocolate left, and she made it and sent it to the president of Hershey's. And he said, anybody, and he, she got a letter back, anybody that makes candy this good, chocolate this good, deserves to have our chocolate. So she became the only person who was allowed to buy chocolate from Hershey's. And I guess if you're making chocolate, chocolate varies quite a bit. And maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. So there are a lot of chocolate suppliers. And again, Hershey is typically not one that that we talk about. But there's a number of different suppliers that you can buy chocolate from of a wide variety. And most of the people that supply chocolate have kind of a low end, cheaper chocolate, and all the way up to a higher couverture type of thing. And typically, the difference between those are there's a number of things. One is the quality of the beans that the chocolates are made from. Mm. So there's better beans than other beans that have been fermented correctly, been roasted properly, and with the right characteristics. Most chocolates are mixtures of blends of different cocoa beans from different sources to get the specific flavor that a company's looking for. Nowadays, you can buy single origin chocolates from some companies, and you know they can have particularly good profiles as well. If you walked around, so Madison has, what, four or five different high-end chocolatiers, and they all buy their chocolate from a variety of sources, whether it's a French source or a Belgian source or California source or even Chicago. But again, each chocolate has a different characteristic based on the ingredients that were used to make it and the processes that they were used to make it. So they're pretty wide range of characteristics. Yep.
Yeah. Purchased a lot of Gail Ambrosius chocolates, and she actually goes to South America she travels there to visit the places to see the process in action, and makes some pretty good chocolates.
She brings back some beans, I think, and makes her own single origin as well.
Yeah. Yes. Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to follow up on the idea of candy glass, using it for windows. And it's still in use by the movie industry. As a matter of fact, when Men in Black was filmed at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, there was a crashing through the front doors, and the front doors are glass, but they were replaced with candy glass so the actors weren't hurt as they were crashing through the door. So it's still in use.
Oh, Suzanne, thank you.
Yeah, my understanding was that most of that had been replaced by polyurethane type thing. So if you go look at movie glass, you know, the thing that bottle that's made with a glass-looking material that people bonk over the heads, now that's mostly polyurethane. But, yeah, it's interesting.
Thank you, Suzanne. I appreciate that very much. Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Your turn. Thank you for calling, Bruce. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hello. It's a great show. I have some friends that have a candy shop in Knife River. It's called Great Lakes Candy Kitchen, and they make great candies and chocolates. But they have said to me they're using a big copper bowl when they make the candy, you know, so they're hand mixing it and so on, and it's delicious. They make great candy. And so I just wondered what's the deal with the copper pot or copper bowl?
Yeah, good question, Bruce. Thanks for calling. Rich, what about it?
Yeah, copper is sort of the traditional kettle material that was traditionally used to make candy. We have a bunch of those here in our labs as well, although we're phasing those out because harder to control. But the reason copper works so well is because it transfers heat really nicely. So it has a very high thermal conductivity for heat. And if you put flame down on the bottom, the heat transfers all the way up the sides, and so you get a more uniform cook. Stainless steel, on the other hand, is a lot easier, but and easier to clean and better actually for the shelf life of the product, but it doesn't transfer heat quite as well. So one of the reasons copper is not so great is because copper ions actually promote lipid oxidation. So if you're making English toffee, for example, in a copper kettle, your shelf life will be a little bit lower because of lipid oxidation over time.
Thanks for that question. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. I have a daughter and her husband and two little granddaughters up in Sitka, Alaska. Well, they make caramels up there. Their license goes all over the world, and they're called the Sweet Sisters Caramels. Well, a while ago, I had two caramels left, and Mary called me one day, and I said, you know what, Mary, I only have two of those caramels left. And what do you know, in about a week and a half, I got a box with, I don't know how many, there must have been about 8 or 10 boxes of caramels in there. And I have four different flavors. But boy, I'll tell you, when you talked about candy, darn it, I thought, you know what, I got that box of those caramels in the closet. I'm going to have to go and get them out, otherwise I eat too many. And I got one in my mouth right now as we're talking. And it is really good. But, you know, licensed all over the world, they can send them. But it's from Sitka, Alaska.
Oh, Sitka, Alaska. Well, Nancy, thank you for that. Sitka, Alaska. Sitka salmon is, there's another kind of at least a national brand, but that has to do with fish. Salmon, for sure. And is it tough to... You know, I'm thinking about this. You got candy you're selling all over the world. I mean, how do you make? You got to have some pretty quick delivery, or and you know the temperatures and the summer and so forth. Rich, I assume there's problems.
Yeah, shipping candy can be real, real challenging. Some of them are much more sensitive than others. Caramel is actually fairly robust. You know, some of the caramels you buy at a grocery store, granted, they're not as good as the Sitka caramels, I'm sure, were probably made 6 months ago and have that kind of shelf life. But typically, a high-end gourmet caramel, sounds like that's what you're getting, has a higher water content and tends to cold flow or deform, even at room temperature. And of course, if it goes into a warm environment or a warm truck, it can flow pretty bad. So, yeah, some candies are again more robust than others. Of course, you know that you can't ship chocolate in the summertime unless you have a really good insulated box with some cold packs as well.
Thanks again, Nancy. Amy in Door County, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Admittedly, my question is more about baking, but the question part has to do with chocolate, so I hope you might be able to answer this for me. My son has a dairy-free diet, and I was just wondering if using carob chips melted as an icing or frosting on cookies, would that be a direct substitution for real chocolate?
Well, in my opinion, no, because carob has a very different flavor. Looks the same, maybe behaves the same a little bit, but I don't think it tastes the same. But if it's non-dairy, almost every dark chocolate, not everyone, but almost every dark chocolate is non-dairy. I mean, by definition, it's cocoa solids, which and cocoa butter, which comes from the plant, then sugar, which is plant-based, and then a few other things, but lecithin and vanilla are the main other ingredients. If there's a little bit of milk fat or, of course, a milk chocolate, then, of course, but a lot of companies are now making dairy-free milk chocolates. So oat-based milk chocolates are becoming common as well. But again, you can make a dark chocolate coating that's non-dairy.
Yeah, there you go, Amy. It's probably a little more expensive, a little higher end, but you can do it for sure. So check that out. Stephen, Green Bay, hi.
Hey, Larry. I've got a question about flavorings. My mother used to make it's a hard crack stained glass candy that she used to flavor cinnamon, wintergreen, clove, those sorts of things with oil. And I swear she only used a couple of drops. And when my sister and my wife and I made it this Christmas, we bought similar, what we thought were oils from a store called Michael's. And we had to really put a lot more into it than what my mom did. And I was wondering if the professor could tell me what's going on there.
Okay.
Yeah, so flavors are a whole interesting field within the food industry. And there are huge flavor houses, there's what we call them, that that mix up all the different chemicals that go into some of those flavors. And so probably the actual flavor and component in what you got was lower than what your mom got. I mean, I don't know for sure, but a typical flavoring like that is mostly the carrier, and that carrier can be water or it can be oil. And then the flavoring compounds themselves and the concentration of those flavoring compounds, you know, it can vary depending on the source of that flavor. So that would be my guess, is that you just got a flavor system that just didn't have the same concentration.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you for calling, Steve. Daryl in Menominee Falls, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I think I found my answer as far as why, when you watch the old Westerns, how John Wayne and Clint Eastwood could fall through a saloon window and not get a cut on them or ride their horse right through it. So I found this sounds a very practical way of reusing candy.
Well, they made those panes specially for the movies. Again, it's sugar glass, but not as sharp and brittle as a silica glass.
Rich, two of your students won $1 million in a TV show, The Amazing Race. I think I emailed you once and said, hey, would you mind if I have them on the show? How are those, they're not kids for sure, they were PhD students. How are they doing?
Well, I still talk to most of my former students. Amy, she worked on a sugar project, so she actually worked on a sugar replacement, sorbitol. But she works now for Mars Wrigley. She's a high-level research scientist there with a PhD. And then Maya Warren, who was on the ice cream side of things, she went to work for a company and then did a couple other things. But now she's a consultant on her own, working with anybody that has ice cream questions. So they're both doing really well.
That's good. I watched every episode of The Amazing Race they were on, and it was really fun having them on. I just wondered how they were doing. And you don't often get millionaires for PhD students. At least sure. I never did.
Yep.
Some of them might have made a million afterwards. But, Rich, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun. Would you come back and do this again with us? We had lots of questions that we didn't get answered, to be perfectly honest.
Sure, I'm happy to do it.
Thank you so much. Richard Hartle, I should say, everybody calls him Rich, is a professor of food science at the UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us. We never really did get into his research at all, and I think we get him on again. I want to maybe delve into that a little bit. Well, you know, we've talked chocolate and related it to Valentine's. What's the other thing you think about when you think about Valentine's Day and maybe gifts? One I think of is flowers, and we're going to talk about flowers next here on the Ideas Network with the owner of the Petal Pusher Floral Studio in Green Bay. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Well, we talked candy. Time to turn our attention to a bouquet of flowers for this Valentine's Day. Larry Mueller here. We'll be talking with Nicole Campbell, who is the owner of Petal Pusher Floral Studio, located in Green Bay. Nicole is the lead designer there. She also grows her own flowers when the weather allows, and is president of the Wisconsin and Upper Michigan Florist Association. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Why do you love receiving or giving flowers? What are your favorite types to see in a bouquet? Or maybe you design bouquets yourself. Maybe you have questions about making your bouquet last a little bit longer. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Nicole Campbell, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Of course. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
How'd you get involved in the floral industry?
Honestly, this was my very first job in high school. I needed to get a job. We were at the grocery store. They had a little floral department. And my mom said, hey, how about this? So I walked in and applied and fell in love with it. It's an industry. It's an easy industry to fall in love with.
Oh, yeah, for sure. How long is Petal Pusher your business? How long has that been around?
It was originally started back in 1992. I started working for that owner, 96, something like that. And then I bought the business back in 2006. So it's been quite, it's had quite a history.
That's a big, how'd you make that big decision?
He owned another business up in Door County and he was looking to simplify his life. Yeah. And I loved it. I couldn't imagine working anywhere else or doing anything else. So it just was kind of the right opportunity. And having worked within the business, I felt like I understood a little bit of what I was signing up for. So I can say as a small business owner, you really never understand it till you live it. Because it's just, it's your life, you know, so, but it's wonderful.
And you have a staff?
I do. Yes. There's about 12 of us total. A lot of them are part-time. A lot of them have other jobs, you know, school teacher, different things like that, and just help out part-time on the weekends. We do a lot of weddings and that sort of thing. So I'm really fortunate. I have a great, great group of ladies.
And a furry one, too.
Yes. Yes. Probably the biggest deal at our shop is our little shop kitty. Her name is Pippa Pepper. She has her own business cards. The governor stopped in to meet her. She has her own social media presence. She's kind of a big deal in a pint-sized little package.
What's her name?
Pippa Pepper.
Pippa Pepper. All right.
Yep. They're
in at the Petal Pusher. Pippa Pepper.
Yes.
Pepper at the Petal Pusher.
Yeah, say that three times fast.
So what's a typical day of work at work?
That's part of what's great about this job is that every day truly is different. We do daily deliveries for birthdays, get well, anniversaries. We do wedding and event works. We do funerals. So every day varies in terms of what it's comprised of. And then there's all the behind the scenes, you know, the processing of the flowers, the stocking the cooler, all of those things that go behind the scenes before we actually create the flowers. And then we have people that stop in the shop. We're located right on Broadway in downtown Green Bay. So there's people that just walk the sidewalk and pop into the different businesses and stuff. So the variety of it is part of what's, I think, so great about it.
How would you describe your style as you now a floral designer? What's involved in it and how would you describe your style?
We are known for a very natural style. There's a lot of, you know, dyed and painted flowers that are out there in the market right now. We don't do much with that. We're really known for letting nature influence and guide our work. So we try to reinterpret, you know, the flowers in a beautiful way, but always being mindful of the fact that it's a natural product and we want it to stay connected to that. I think that's part of what's great about fresh flowers is it's bringing a little bit of nature into your home or your office or something. So we try to stay true to that aesthetic.
I was never any good at it. I mean, if I just bought some flowers and stuck them in a vase, and then there's usually some other little things that go along with it. It always looked like a mess when I did it.
Most people say that, but honestly, most people don't practice a lot. You know, we practice every day. How often have you practiced designing flowers? It is kind of a practice makes perfect job. But there are some basic fundamentals that can help a lot. If you buy a bouquet at the grocery store, like what do we do with this now? And proper care and handling is very important with that. But from a design standpoint, starting with greenery, starting with something that gives you structure in the vase first and then adding flowers is always a better approach. Most people go backwards. They put the flowers in first and then they add the greens at the end. You want to start with your greenery first, and then that'll help hold the flowers in place to some degree.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'd always stick the flowers in first and then try to put in those fronds or whatever they were around the outside. Yeah. It never really worked very well. Oh, my gosh. So you're a natural...
Yes.
The natural style. And obviously it must be pretty, you've been doing this for a while now. You've been your own business since 2006. So you must be successful or you wouldn't be in business.
No. And it can be a challenging industry simply because of the fact that what we sell is a perishable product, you know, so you really have to be mindful of your inventory and turning it over in an appropriate timeline so that it's fresh flowers going out the door to your customers. So it has its quirks because of that. But yeah, we feel very fortunate to have been as successful as we have been.
So to what extent does social media these days play a role, or your website, or any of that business? And as far as the business side of it.
It's huge. It is absolutely huge for us. Because what we do is very visual, being able to put our images of our work in front of customers on Instagram and Facebook and that sort of thing is amazing. And having that website presence where people have the convenience of just ordering online or going through our wedding galleries on our website is huge. So that really, we have tried very hard to stay at the forefront of that and be current with what avenues are out there for social media, because we realize how important it is to us. We haven't jumped on TikTok yet, but I think we probably need to eventually. But yeah, we really treasure that. And my husband works in IT. He has a real job, if you will, outside of the small business ownership. So his IT background is a huge help too, because he's great at paying attention to what we should be looking at next and keeping our website up to date and all that wonderful stuff.
And here we've got V-Day coming here, Valentine's Day, a week away or so. And this time, this is your Super Bowl?
Mm-hmm. It is our Super Bowl. It is our single busiest day of the entire year. And I think it's kind of coincidental that they've moved the Super Bowl to be very close to Valentine's Day in recent years. But yeah, we do more business in a day on Valentine's Day than we do in other weeks. So it's a very intensive time for us.
So the problem is, you know, you're dealing with a perishable, so you can't just start. I mean, when do you start preparing for something like this?
We actually get our flowers on order. We let the farms know what we're looking for flowers way back in December, because they have to have enough lead time to grow this product for the industry. So we're placing our orders for our roses and all of that stuff is happening back in December. The flowers all are in movement, shall we say, right now. They're being shipped, you know, to the various stores and that sort of thing. They're moved via what we call cold chain. So they're kept cold while they're being transported. So they're almost in like a state of suspended animation. And then we will begin processing like a few days before Valentine's Day, because it does take some time to rehydrate these flowers. Then once they've been kind of brought out of suspended animation, we want a little bit of time to get them drinking again and get them started opening. And then we actually start designing them into arrangements like the day or two before.
So then it's all hands on deck.
It literally is all hands on deck. Everybody on my staff pretty much works. And then I ask them to ask their family and friends to come in and help. So I have moms of some of my staff coming in. I have husbands of some of my staff members coming in because we need extra delivery drivers. We need people to answer the phones, all of those things. So you don't have to be a skilled floral designer to work in floral shop on Valentine's Day. If you can drive a car or pick up a telephone, you could be helpful.
Nicole Campbell, our guest today. And she is the owner of Petal Pusher Floral Studio in Green Bay. And she's also president of the Wisconsin and Upper Michigan Florist Association. We can talk with her a little about that. She's going to be with us right up until 12:30, and you'll have a chance to ask your question right after we take a quick look at the news. We'll be back with our guest, Nicole Campbell. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at flowers and the florist industry here in Wisconsin. The florist industry, February is its biggest month of the year. And Nicole Campbell is with us. She is the owner of Petal Pusher Floral Studio. Petal Pusher Floral Studio in Green Bay, and Nicole's the lead designer there, also grows her own flowers when the weather allows. She's president of the Wisconsin and Upper Michigan Florist Association as well. So I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe share why flowers bring you happiness. Do you have problems keeping your flower arrangements going for any length of time? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And emailed us, what do you do to protect yourself and your employees from the chemicals in cut flowers? I'm trying to think of the chemicals that might be in cut flowers. Go talk about that.
Yeah. That's part of the reason that we're passionate about having our own flower farm, because our own farm, we don't use any pesticides. We grow as cleanly as we possibly can. When flowers are imported from South America or Holland or California, we can't control what is being used on those products. And there are some pesticides that are required for rose production and things of that nature. A lot of designers do design with gloves on if you're sensitive to any of those sorts of things. And obviously, we would not recommend anybody consume any of these flowers. You know, sometimes people will call us and ask about edible options, and none of those would be considered safe for that. But yeah, as long as you're not consuming them or ingesting them, you know, and you're just admiring them, you shouldn't have to worry about any of those pesticides. But if you're concerned about exposure when you're handling them, gloves is always a good option.
So, and these, you have suppliers that may come from other parts of the country, as you say.
Yeah, all over the world.
Or the world, mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it really is a worldwide industry. And especially, obviously, being in Wisconsin, we can't grow things year-round. Our seasons just don't really allow that. So, for example, most roses come from South America. Ecuador is the biggest producer for those. All of the tulips usually come out of Holland in the beginning of the year. Then we start to get them from Canada. Peonies come from Holland. And then as the seasons progress, Alaska is actually a big exporter of peonies now because they have those long days over the summer, and it's a later season than what the rest of the world can produce. So it's a global marketplace. And obviously there's that huge auction in Holland that so many flowers move through and then are distributed to florists all over.
It's an amazing process for sure. So what's the most popular flower for Valentine's Day? Is it the rose?
It is. It's a classic, you know, and it will always have its place. But here, I think because it is the middle of winter in Wisconsin, we actually see tulips as a really popular choice because it's that reminder that spring is coming, but we know they're a ways away in our own gardens yet. So being able to have tulips on your table in the middle of February, I think is just a highlight for us because it's still winter or supposed
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. I mean,
they are.
Yeah, and it's something you just, oh, tulips. You just think about them in spring, and so it's a pleasant surprise for sure to get them. What are your tips for someone looking to order a beautiful Valentine's bouquet, you know, a calling, you know, where do you go and all that sort of thing?
I always recommend to people, if you're calling in and you're really unsure of what you want, ask the designer that you're talking to on the phone what they would like. Because we're innately selfish creatures. We want to work with the prettiest flowers in the cooler. So if somebody calls up and they're unsure of what they want to have sent, I want to suggest whatever I have on my shelf that is the most stunning thing I can work with. So that's always good because, and our inventory changes every day. You know, it's a perishable product. So there's new flowers coming in and going out every single day. So talking with the designer about what they would want to work with. And then anytime you're calling a florist, make sure you're finding a florist that has an actual physical address in the city that you're calling. There are a lot of what we call order gatherers out there now that you can find online. And all they're going to do is charge you an extra fee and then relay the order through a local florist. So you wind up paying for something that you're not getting more flowers for.
So, yeah, that's a good tip. I mean, you want to... So, in other words, you want to look for the look at the florist, and then what's their address?
Make sure that, because a lot of times if you search for, hey, a florist in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you'll get some order gatherers that'll come up as your top search results who actually aren't florists in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They just have themselves listed as such. So make sure you're getting a florist that's actually within the zip code your delivery is going to or has a physical address in that city.
So talk a bit more about your own farm.
Yeah, we're really proud of that. There's a lot of farms are starting to get established in Wisconsin. And that's a really wonderfully exciting thing to say because as the previous caller mentioned, you know, now we have control over what's being used on our products, how they're being grown. And that's important to us. So we do everything really naturally and cleanly without the use of pesticides out there. And it allows us to grow things that we can't otherwise access. Not all flowers handle shipping well. You know, so if something is a very delicate flower that can't handle being transported, the only way we can get it is from a local farm, be it our own or another farm. So that's great because it lets some other flowers come back into use that we kind of had shied away from because they couldn't handle being transported. And now we can have them in our designs again, which is really wonderful.
What are some examples?
The biggest one I would say is cosmos daisies. And, you know, if you're a gardener in Wisconsin, you know what those look like. But they can't handle being shipped. So unless we can get them locally, we can't get them at all. So that's a big one. And obviously the flowers coming off of our farm are fresher than anything that we can bring in because you're going to have a little bit of time in transit while those flowers are being shipped that will ultimately affect their vase life. So we like to have that local option too for freshness.
Yeah, I would think that'd be, so you're growing those on your farm. Is this like 2 acres or is this, what do you got?
Good guess. Yes, it's exactly just about 2 acres. we split production between perennials, you know, that'll come back for us every year. A lot of those are Wisconsin native prairie plants. My degree is in plant biology, so I like to get kind of nerdy about some of the plant choices. And then the other half is annuals that we replant every year.
Well, that makes it makes good sense. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And we're going to be hearing from, let's go to Mark in Bowler. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Howdy. I heard you mention peonies from Alaska, and I worked at the Perfect Peony Flower Farm in Homer for 2 different years. And when it gets to be busy in June and July, we process thousands and thousands of them. In fact, one day we shipped out 75,000 of them on a FedEx truck, and they all go out by air. And Rita, who runs the place, has 3 different walk-in coolers, and she's able to keep those from July until October in suspended, not animation, but in suspension, like you had mentioned. Just thought I'd add that to your show.
Well, thanks, Mark, for calling. Homer, Alaska.
Yeah, it is really remarkable when you keep that, like he said, when you hold it suspended like that. When the flower is cut, if you keep it dry, dark, and cold, it just kind of shuts down and just goes to sleep for a little bit. And so, yeah, like he said, those peonies that are coming into bloom in June and July can be held in that state all the way, like you mentioned, into October. And it really is just a little bit of science magic behind the scenes, which is remarkable.
Well, let's talk about once it gets to my house, because they die quickly, or at least seem to. What are some tips to share with us for taking care of cut flowers at home?
Yeah. Everybody's familiar with that little packet of flower food that you usually get with the flowers. Read the directions. That is the most important thing. Most people just rip it open, dump it in the vase, and add the water. But there's actually directions on there about how much food is supposed to go in depending on how much water you're using. And that proportion can make a big difference in affecting the vase life. So following those directions correctly is important. It's actually better to not use the food at all if you're going to use it wrong. So follow the directions.
Well, I have never looked at the direction. So maybe that's why I have a problem.
Yeah, that will definitely help. Room temperature water, too. Most people think cold water, but starting them out in room temperature water is always a good idea. Making sure you give them a fresh cut with a clean knife or pruners. And as soon as you cut that stem, you want to cut off about 1 inch and then put them right into water. Don't let them lay on the counter and then put them into water. They got to go right into water.
Yeah, I was told to try and cut them while they're in water or running water. And
that has been a bit of advice, but it can be a little bit impractical for people. So we don't have that necessary expectation, though there are fancy underwater cutters you can buy out there now. But most people don't have one of those lying around at home. So just a clean cut and going right into water usually is enough. And then making sure that none of the leaves or petals or anything are falling under that water line, because that just encourages bacterial growth. And that can be a real problem for flowers in a vase.
Well, that's another thing I've done wrong now that I think about it.
Yep. You don't want to see anything just below that water line, because that'll just get that water really murky really fast.
Maureen in Manitowoc has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Larry. I want to share something that I learned from your show probably well over 10 years ago, and that is that you go out now and you cut some dogwood branches that are such pretty red ones, put them in water, and you will see leaves and then eventually blossoms, and they're going to be so pretty in whatever arrangement you use.
Oh, I had forgotten that, Maureen. Thanks for that reminder. Nicole, comment?
Yeah, there are a lot of beautiful things that can be foraged. You know, if you have some shrubs in your yard or something like that, or even if you buy that bundle from the grocery store, don't be afraid, like Maureen suggested, to go and prune a couple of additional branches to give some additional structure and that sort of thing. And if you have pussy willow or curly willows or any of those willows, those usually, when you cut them, if you use them in a vase, it will not only leaf out, but it will also form roots at the bottom. If you've ever experienced that, they'll root in water, and then that can be planted out and can be another shrub in the yard if you want. So,
oh boy. Maureen, thank you very much for that reminder and comment. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question you made me think about many years ago, my mother passed away, and her favorite flower was Queen Anne's lace, which I always said I still love it myself. It's a beautiful, I think it was a wildflower, but I've since learned it's considered invasive. And, you know, you see it in the ditches a lot. And first of all, how, as a florist, is that something you would ever grow intentionally? And second of all, what's your thought about using, you know, wildflowers like that and, you know, it, to sell and, you know, in that way? I thought it was, like I say, it was just something that kind of interesting to me.
Sure.
Yeah, we do use Queen Anne's lace. It's not something that we grow at our farm, but as you mentioned, it is invasive. So we do have some that exist on our property. There are other flower substitutes that look quite a bit like Queen Anne's lace that we grow instead. One is called Ami Green Mist. And then there's a chocolate lace flower. They're a little bit easier to control. They don't have quite as many invasive tendencies, and they're a little more durable. If you've ever experienced Queen Anne's lace, can sometimes be a little finicky when put in, when cut and put into water. The Ami Green Mist is just a little bit, has a little more longevity to it. So we do prefer that one. But yeah, we are totally here for that wildflower look. As you know, having a florist that's a little bit more of a natural and organic style, we love embracing that kind of aesthetic in our design. But of course, you want to make sure that you're harvesting responsibly and in property that you have permission to do so and that sort of thing. So we would want to make sure that people are being mindful of where the flowers are coming from and that they're okay flowers for them to harvest if they are going to go out and do some wildflower gathering.
Yeah, Karen, good points. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. John wanted to know, how do you design or how does the design of a bouquet affect its longevity, or does it?
It does. The most challenging thing with flowers, like for example, if you think about a long stem rose, the flower's up at the top and then that cut end is where that stem is drawing water. As much as we love long stem roses, the longer that stem becomes, the harder it is for that stem to move that fluid up to that rose at the top that needs to open. So actually doing designs that are more compact and low usually equates to longer vase life, because it's not as challenging for that rose to draw that water up, for example. So that is one thing we usually encourage. Or if you've ever had an experience where you have roses and that head nods over, oftentimes cut it down shorter and put it in a low compact design and you'll get that flower to pop back up.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, if you have a little bowl, if you start with a taller and then switch them to a small, kind of almost like a bowl.
Yeah, you can have a whole nother run of them of enjoyment.
Should you keep your cut flowers in the sun, or is it, I mean, does it matter?
It really does. Sometimes we'll hear from people, well, I put it in a sunny window. Plants want a nice sunny window, but once it's a fresh cut flower, it doesn't. That can really cause them to warm up too much. So we would not recommend a nice sunny spot. Cool, some light, but not sun, it would be preferred.
So indirect light.
Indirect light, yep. And someplace away from cats, pets, things like that too.
Yeah, it's hard for me to have flowers in the house because the cats, two cats, Coco and Tiger, I'm amazed that you can keep your kitty in a florist shop.
She's a very good girl. I have two cats at home and they would not make the cut for being floral shop cats, but Pippa is a very good girl, so she stays out of stuff.
Oh, so what's new in the flower? I mean, are there new flowers? Are there, what's?
Yeah, there are always new flowers. There are always, I shouldn't say new flowers. There's very rarely a new flower, but they're coming up with advancements on flowers that we've had for a long time. And, you know, like everything else, there's popularity. Things ebb and flow in terms of what the consumers want to see. Ranunculus and anemones right now, and peonies and dahlias are the stars of the show. But in the exciting world of what's new in flowers, there's a breeder out of Japan called Suntory who just bred the world's first blue mum, which is, blue is a difficult color for flowers. Yes. So to have a blue mum hit the market was a very exciting thing. So,
And yeah, you. I guess there have been some painted new blue mums out there.
Yes, yes. This one is genetically blue. It's not the dyed blue that you can sometimes see in like grocery store bouquets and that sort of thing.
So, what about proms? I'm thinking back to my senior prom, which I bought. My girlfriend wanted an orchid, which at the time was really expensive.
They're still pretty expensive. So that hasn't changed much. But yes, we do a lot of work for prom. And now their boutonnieres are not the typical little flower that attaches on the lapel. They're a little card that inserts into the pocket of the jacket. So that's a new trend that's happening for the gentlemen. And then we're seeing the ladies, instead of wearing wrist corsages, they're carrying little bouquets of flowers instead of wearing them. So fun new things that are happening.
So what do you do carrying them? Yeah. It's kind of weird. I mean, if you're dancing or whatever.
I don't think they take it with to the dance part, but they look really charming for all the photos ahead of time.
Okay, got it. And someone else is wondering, how often do you change the water in a vase?
As soon as you see it start to get cloudy or murky, is ideal. And anytime you change that water, you want to go back to room temperature water and give those stems a fresh cut again. So when you dump that water out, clean your vase with soap and water, put room temperature water back in, and recut those stems.
And so room temperature, you pour some water out, let it sit.
Well, you can have it, you know, kind of go with room temperature coming out of the tap, just kind of gauge it. It doesn't have to necessarily sit.
are there any classics that never go out of style?
Oh, absolutely. Roses being one of them. I mean, they're still my favorite flower, hands down. But, you know, roses, orchids are another classic. Hydrangea, calla lilies, those will never change.
And you're going to be, well, you're a busy gal anyway, but you're going to be a really busy gal in just a few days. So is it the 13th or is it the 14th itself that's the busiest?
It's the 14th for sure. Yep.
Lots of walk-in, I imagine.
Lots of walk-ins, lots of phone calls from people at work going, oh, my coworker just got flowers. I better send something to my significant other. So it sneaks up on people, but we're used to that.
Nicole, lots of fun talking with you. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Perhaps we can do this again. Enjoy talking
Sounds
with
great.
You.
Thank you.
Nicole Campbell and her... her store is, her florist shop is called Petal Pushers Floral Studio in Green Bay, and she ships them around, I'm sure. So you go online to her website, type in Petal Pushers Floral Studio, and you're going to find her. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the Packers' history in Super Bowls and then look at this year's game. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.